From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour takes us to the future, the classical music future, where pieces like the one you're hearing now may become even more popular. This one's called Scherzo Liquido by composer Mason Bates. Bates was recently named the most performed composer of his generation and the 2018 Composer of the Year by Musical America. He's known for combining electronic elements with full orchestras, something Bach or Beethoven obviously weren't doing. It's the type of cutting-edge creation that experts say could push classical music to the next stage. Well, like many things, classical music is going through an evolutionary phase. With the digital age changing the way we consume and create music, students, performers, and music leaders alike are developing new and innovative ways to attract and create musical experiences for audiences, especially younger audiences. With concert attendance decreasing and online listening increasing, music leaders and fans are facing the question, what is the future of classical music? Now, the Eastman School hopes to help answer that question this week during a series of events. The conference is called Music in a Time of Change, and participants will hear from noted scholars about the challenges future music leaders are going to face and how they can adapt. And we get a preview of that conference this hour. We're going to take a look at the current and future state of classical music, and we know we kind of joked before the hour began, it's become a genre unto itself. Classical music is dead. No, it's not. Well, it's dying. No, it isn't. It's sort of this thing where every 2 or 3 years you see a big article, Time Magazine, U.S. News and World Report, somebody's got a thought on it. Our guests have great insight this hour, so let's dig right in with Jim Dozer, director of the Institute for Music Leadership at the Eastman School of Music. Jim, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Also with us is Bob Freeman. Bob's a pianist, author, former director of the Eastman School of Music and the New England Conservatory, and former dean of the College of Fine Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. Bob, welcome to the program.
Great pleasure to be back in Rochester.
Oh, wonderful to have you. And Robert Winter is a distinguished professor of music at UCLA. Nice to have you here.
Nice to be on the right coast, more or less.
Yes, indeed, sir. Jim, first for our listeners, what is the Institute for Music Leadership for those who are not attending?
The Institute for Music Leadership complements musical training that students receive at the Eastman School with career training and resources.
All right. And so can we just get right out of the gate here? I want to say that Bob Freeman is someone who is maybe best positioned to answer this question of the state of classical music. You even wrote a book about it with the word crisis in the title, though you told us before the hour began that was the work of the marketing department.
That's the publisher who said, that's a good word, let's put that in. And I said, sure.
What was the full name of the book, Bob?
Well, the book says that there's a problem and that we cannot,
do me a favor, get right on your mic for me there.
We cannot solve the problem without working together, which is to say the parents of young musicians themselves, the faculty, the deans, the provosts who hire the deans, the people who run the foundations, all have to recognize the fact that there is a problem with the audience. I wanted to begin by saying, Evan, that I was director from 72 to 96. The last time, the last semester I was in my directorship of the school, I paid a visit in Vienna to the guy who was heading the Hochschule für Musik und Darstellende Kunst in Vienna, where I'd been once a graduate student on a Fulbright. When I walked into the door of his office, and I had not met the man before, he said, I'd like to welcome to Vienna the director of the world's greatest music school. And I said, that's very nice to say. What brings you to that conclusion 4,000 miles from Rochester? And he said, you have from the beginning, as far as I can figure out, paid attention to the state of the audience for the music that we care about. And nobody else in the world is doing that. So we think of Eastman as a more total music school than I think of any other music school in Europe or in the United States at that point.
And when did he pay that compliment?
That was 1996.
And 22 years later, how do you view Eastman's place?
The administration of the school since then, particularly during the time of Doug Lowry and now Jamal Rossi, is continuing to keep Eastman in first place, as it shows up in a lot of polls. There was a Newsweek poll about 5 years ago which named Eastman the hottest music school in the country.
Well, we are certainly proud of that distinction, and what we want is to have a future in a lot of different genres of music, but with an eye on classical music. Is it tiresome to see these think pieces every 6 months, every 2 years come out? Or do you think that it's valuable to kind of continue to ask the question of where the state of the
industry is? Oh, I think there's a great value in having the question posed by people like you and XXI in this program to remind people that there's always times for change, and time is changing more rapidly now than it ever has been before. Things just weren't the way they were when I was a child in all kinds of things. I mean, there was no television when I was a child.
Well,
to begin with, and it took forever to get from one place to another. what I can say about the Viennese comment is that all of this goes back to George Eastman. I used to teach at MIT, and in those days, especially when I left MIT, I was told, oh, you're going to be the director of the music branch of MIT in the West, to which I said to the president of MIT, sir, with all due respect, you are an anonymous waif, but Mr. Eastman gave us not only the money for a good endowment, but his own name. I mean, we are the Eastman School of Music, and the design which we're following was his for the future of the community.
Well, today there's an interview with Bob Freeman on the most critical challenges facing the music leaders of tomorrow and what those leaders can do to take on those challenges. That conversation happens at Hatch Recital Hall from 4 to 5:30. Tomorrow, a presentation by Robert Winter, Teaching in a Truly Digital World, discussing what teaching music will look like in the realm of all digital software. That's also at Hatch from 2:30 to 3:30. On Saturday, a panel on the future of classical music, moderated by Jamal Rossi, the Joan and Martin Messinger Dean of the Eastman School of Music, at the Hatch Recital Hall. That's at 10 a.m. And so, by the way, you can stream all of those conversations and presentations live on the Institute for Music Leadership website. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
All right. And at the end of these 3 days here, if we're successful, Jim, we will leave these events with what sense? Is it a sense of mission, a sense of purpose? I suppose different attendees will have different ideas on what the future of music looks like here. But what is the overall goal?
I'm going to say that of all the goals, the most important is a sense of personal responsibility of musicians, educators, professionals, students, in that the real key to improving audience development is that one-on-one interaction that we have as members of our community to advocate and evangelize for the value of classical music in our world.
Okay. And let me also bring in Robert Winter, who's... I want to ask you a question that's a little bit apart from the presentation you'll be giving tomorrow, and I'm going to quote a 2016 CNN piece by Charlie Albright, a classical pianist, titled "Classical Music is Dying, and That's the Best Thing for Classical Music." It pointed to rules of concert etiquette as a reason for the projected death of classical, referring to things like clapping mid-piece or at the end of movements becoming unacceptable, or applause between movements or being frowned upon. Or from a performing standpoint, performers being forbidden to speak from the stage or improvise in a concert. And Charlie Albright called the atmosphere stifling. I wonder if that's become a cliche criticism, or do you think that that is a fair criticism?
Oh, it's absolutely valid.
Yeah?
I asked my students at UCLA, when Franz Liszt, the great virtuoso pianist composer of the 19th century, gave concerts, what was the scene like? And the deal was, he stood at the door before everybody came in, shook all of their hands as they came in, had a brief conversation with them all. Then he went up to the stage and played for an hour and a half, 2 hours, talking all the time. And third, you can imagine, the sort of postlude to this is he walked back to the door where people came in and greeted everybody as they left. And of course, they're all aghast, like, what? You know, I thought you walked out onto a quiet stage and bowed, you know, scowled like Rachmaninoff, and sat down and played for 2 hours and then got up and scowled to great acclaim and walked off. And they, it's, you know, schools of music are, in a sense, offspring of conservatories. And the word conservatory is there for a reason. I mean, these are the most, you know, slow-moving, slow-to-change kind of institutions. They're conserved. That's why they were called conservatories.
No, the reason they were called conservatories was in the first part of the 16th century. There were four such institutions in Vienna, in Venice, and they were conserving the virtue of young women to a marriageable age. The meaning that you're accustomed to, they started admitting men at the end of the 16th century, and then everything went to hell. But
okay, but back to Robert's point here. That it was Liszt you were describing?
Yes.
Who had that custom? And now, look, I'm sure we have listeners right now hearing this saying, I don't think tradition is stodgy. I think there's a reason for it. I think that there's a decorum. I like the etiquette. What do you say to that audience?
Sure. Well, there's plenty of space for that. It doesn't mean that everybody should be eating their pizza and chewing as loud as they can during a quiet, you know, chamber music performance. But it does mean that you have to loosen the thing up. I mean, the concert routine really is a kind of 20th century invention, this utter quiet. John Sullivan Dwight was an 19th century New Englander, and it is he who instilled the notion that going to a concert was the secular version of going to church, literally. So you have the sacralization of classical music. And it all came from the sort of East Coast corridor and then spread west. And then, you know, we had this phenomenon of Toscanini and the top 40 classical pieces of the 1940s. And, you know, classical music became kind of commodified sort of element in American culture. And the more it became that, of course, the more it became out of step with the world that we're all getting more and more used to now. I mean, I have kids who come into my classes. They don't know anything other than computers and Facebook. They've never known anything else.
But I guess the argument could be, but can we teach them? Should we teach them?
Oh, absolutely. Sure. But I think what the Leadership Institute here is doing and other places is, but especially here, and I have to say, I mean, I'm a great fan of the Eastman School. Many of my students apply to come here after undergraduate, is that you have a real commitment on the part of the institution here with this institute to make it not just a token part of a curriculum, but something that really, you know, over half of the students take part in during their time here. And that notion of self-responsibility that Jim was alluding to is really at the heart of it. Students used to say, well, what are you going to do when you graduate? I'm going to apply for the New York Philharmonic oboe position. So they're all thinking of those. Well, there are a shrinking number of those jobs. But if you know that you're going to have to, wherever you go, if you go to Omaha or someplace downstate in New York or whatever, you're going to be responsible for creating opportunities for yourself, then different, you know, the opportunities are endless. And Bob talks about that a lot in his book.
Hmm. You know, Jim, I think here in Rochester, I want to offer an observation just about the Rochester Philharmonic. And I'm a big fan of not only Ward Stair and his leadership there, but what that organization has done for years. And I think what I'm seeing with Ward Stair, and I'm curious to know if you agree, is an effort to sort of split the difference between what Robert is talking about, what some would call a stodgy tradition, others would call like the etiquette that should be celebrated. I think Ward is trying to split the difference between that notion of celebrating that tradition while also breaking down some of the barriers, the pre-performance discussion, the chats, some of the interaction there. I see him as being much more accessible than some other leaders in classical music around the country. I see him very present in a lot of different places. They put themselves in schools. And so it's not just a series of concerts at Eastman with no discussion, no access, et cetera. But it is still preserving some of the tradition. I wonder if you think that they're making that effort.
Oh, I certainly do, and I know the RPO from many perspectives. One, playing in the RPO mm-hmm. for many years, but also sitting in the audience. And I think that, Evan, the key to what you're saying is it's an attitude. It's an attitude from the stage, from the musicians, that they are indeed part of this Rochester community, and they interact. And we see Rochester musicians participating in the community in so many different ways and being, committed to using their skills and talents to make a difference in the daily lives of people in our community. So I think Ward is a great reflection of that, and I'll take some credit for that because Ward, as a junior high band student, played in our Eastman Wind Ensemble Summer Camps. So I'm going to say that he learned that from me and my colleagues, and we're very proud of him.
Is there also something to the concern that anyone must have in a leadership position in an orchestra, knowing that you look around the country, you'll find stories of orchestra shutting down, paring back, bankruptcy, not everywhere, but certainly everyone in any sort of industry, it seems these days, is facing tight financial times, but especially this one. And so if you throw out entirely the traditions, the formality of it, you might lose some of your benefactors who appreciate some of that. And that's another sort of needle to thread, I would think, though that is just a guess from an observing standpoint, Jim.
There's all sorts of reasons why people come to classical music concerts. It could be because that's the thing to do in your community. Mm-hmm. They appreciate it for those traditions. It could be because they're looking for a really unique date night. Who knows why people come there? The trick, though, the key that what we find from organizations that are crossing that line from distress to rejuvenation is that they understand that people are there for different reasons and don't put roadblocks for them to access the music on their own terms.
I have been saying for a long time that music schools would do well to put some of the graduate students to work on the subject of who is the audience, who is the current audience, what kind of musical educational backgrounds do they have, what's their motivation for coming to the concert, are they learning something in college courses which develops a strong thrust and interest in going to concerts? That's a subject on which Eastman knows more than anybody else in the country, but where I think there is a growing willingness to have students in business schools take as serious music and the recruitment of an audience for the future of music as seriously as this group would, Jim and Robert and myself, if we were selling six-cylinder cars instead of four-cylinder cars. Who are the people who buy those and why?
Well, what's the answer right now? Who is the audience right now?
So far as we understand it, the audience is the upper crust of each community. They are the 2 or 3%. In Rochester, they live mostly to the east of the Eastman School instead of to the west of the Eastman School. It should be everything. It should be everybody. Of course, north is not very good here because there aren't very many people who live in Lake Ontario. But
we take the point. It can't just be the 2 to 3%.
Yeah.
Because the end, I think everyone would probably agree that classical music as a genre is in trouble if that doesn't evolve.
Well, be it noted that just as Robert spoke a few minutes ago about the sacralization of music, it's being turned into a church-going-like experience during the 19th century and increasingly even in the first half of the 20th century with which we're stuck now. There have been various efforts made to make it less formal. During the days that I was Eastman School Director, I had the idea of commissioning a work by Joseph Schwantner called New Morning for the World, which was a piece on text by Dr. King for narrator and orchestra, a sort of lengthy Lincoln portrait on a black subject. I asked the late Willie Stargell, famous black baseball player for the Pittsburgh Pirates, to be the narrator. The fact that a baseball player normally doesn't do something like that appealed to a very broad audience. That Willie was doing the narration made not only lots of African Americans show up, but a lot of baseball players. I got in my Eastman office lots of calls from former Major League players and current Major League players who wanted to go to the concert in the Kennedy Center but thought they had to wear white ties and tails. I said, well, you probably don't want to go in a baseball uniform, but just a regular business suit would be perfectly adequate. I'm working now with Jamal Rossi, the distinguished successor as Eastman director, on the possibility of getting Barack and Michelle Obama to come here in the next year or two to perform that piece and another one that I commissioned in Texas for a female narrator and trombone choir.
Well, are you breaking any news? Are they definitely coming?
What I need to get this job done, which is why I raise it in this context, thank you for asking, they get a fee of $1 million a night.
I'm sorry, what's this?
They get...
is that right?
The Obamas. Yeah, any former president of the United States.
A million?
Yeah.
I would have guessed several hundred thousand, but a million.
Well, I haven't negotiated with them. That's their asking price.
I think he only gets 400,000 from Wall Street. Just tell him you're a bank. But a million, I guess a combined fee, because it's just Barack Obama who speaks to Wall Street. So
I have a letter out in the mail right now for which I'm
is
waiting
this just
enthusiastically.
A money issue? It's just a money issue. Yeah. If you can raise the million dollars, the Obamas will be here?
I think so.
Okay.
I have what you have to do, and this is the kind of training that Eastman students get, is to figure out where to get $1 million. My answer so far is Oprah Winfrey, to whom I have a letter out. She's a close friend of theirs, and she has $3.5 billion. So $1 million is a drop in the bucket for her.
All right, so you're working on that. And
so we'll see.
If
any of your listeners have any particular ideas, let
J-Mo Rossi know. You'd like to see Barack and Michelle Obama here. And again, to understand what their role would be, similar, is it the same piece that Willie Stargell narrated, a different?
For President Obama, it would be. The trombone piece is five 3-minute pieces for female narrator and trombone choir. In memory of five important 20th century female black leaders, Marian Anderson, Rosa Parks, Shirley Chisholm, Coretta Scott King, who was admitted to the Eastman School, by the way, as a soprano before she went to Boston, and Barbara Jordan. Mrs. King was nice enough to give me the free rights to his texts. She hadn't done that before.
Wow.
And she called me at 2:30 a.m. one morning because she's a busy lady. I got up in the middle of the night to talk with her. And when she came on, she wanted me to know that she had been admitted as a singer, as a soprano, to Eastman. And she said, I almost came. If I'd come to Eastman, I would have become a very good soprano. But then I would never have met Martin. So.
Well, right now, Dean Rossi, if he's listening, he's doing one of two things. He's either saying, oh, please, Evan, do not promise Rochester that the Obamas are coming next year. Or he's saying, let people know. If we can band together to get them here, we'll do it. But now, go ahead and beat down Dean Rossi's door and tell them that you want Barack and Michelle Obama here. That's one way to certainly raise the profile, the interest. That would have broad-based interest beyond the 2 to 3%. You're right. Robert, what's another way that we get beyond audiences that are, I assume you agree that the audience is still currently, roughly, generally speaking, the 2 to 3%?
In Los Angeles is a little bit different because we do things a little bit differently on the left coast. But in general, sure. I really want to add that the enemy in this lot of us is ourselves. You know that classic remark, we met the enemy and they are us. It's the way we've taught music for a couple hundred years.
Explain.
Really. Well, we built this what I call the three-legged stool. One leg was music history, which was full of facts and dates and opus numbers and number of symphonies and so forth. The other was music theory. I mean, what an intimidating term. You came to Eastman or any place because you loved music and you were thrust into a music theory class where basically you're learning like to speak Italian, but we call it music theory. And it has nothing to do with your music history experience. There's no bridge, no connection. And of course, the third leg is the thing that you came really for is your music lessons. You're actually a so-called applied music. But we've left it to students for, the time immemorial to build the bridges between those areas. And thousands of them each year. I mean, Bob estimates the number. He's the first person, by the way, to ever compute an actual credible number of music graduates in all fields annually. And you want to take a guess yourself, Evan?
Oh, boy. I would embarrass myself.
Probably not. No.
Every year graduating?
You're among friends.
How many institutions are there?
I'm trying collegiate music degrees. There are 4,300 colleges and universities. and almost all of them have music faculty.
I mean, it's in the tens of thousands, right?
Yes. That's a very good guess.
Something like 35,000.
Okay.
And there are not 35,000 current traditional jobs waiting for these, even in schools that have education programs.
Sure.
A lot of these are music education graduates, of course. So one of the things I've been doing for the last 20 years is trying to sort of ask these kids, you know, can you stand up and talk for 10 minutes about why the triad became the ubiquitous sound in music? And they totally freeze, I mean, in the old days. Like, what? I don't know anything about it. I just know how to sort of fill out the multiple choice questions in my exams. I know how to do my theory assignments. And I love playing with my teacher and doing my recitals.
The reason Robert is here is that 20 years ago, he's a very good pianist and a very fine Beethoven scholar. But he also is the king of the relationship between technology and music, that he has been working on that for 25, 30 years now. And there's nobody like him in the United States. That he and I are here together is that he invited me 3 years ago to join a project he's working on called Music in the Air, or MITA, which I believe is going to revolutionize the way in which music can be taught and learned, not only by musicians, but by people like yourself, who are just curious about learning more about music. Robert, tell them about MITA.
Well, many, many years ago, I was approached by a gentleman at a Japanese restaurant, and he said, kept sending over this very expensive bottle of wine, and I kept sending it back as it was a Jordan wine, which is a very fine California wine thing. They must be a case of mistaken identity or something. But he'd been to some of the big national public radio shows I'd done in Los Angeles with 500 participants, so he was in the audience. But anyway, he came up to me and said, you know, you're a multimedia kind of guy. We're going to work together. And my response was, well, I'm Abraham Lincoln at that point. So we began having walks on the beach, and that began my sort of story of digital technologies and music. And when Bob says king, I'm king of a very small section of that, but one that ought to be more significant, and that is, how do you teach kids? And of course, you know, today, the textbook companies, they've got streaming music. You know, you go to on your little iPhone or whatever, you can hear the pieces and so forth. So it's not that the traditional publishers of these books that form the sort of core of most courses haven't been responding at all. But basically what I discovered, this was about 30 years ago, when Bob Stein, the gentleman's name, he brought over, you know, a big, big box. He said, this is a CD-ROM drive, and it weighed about 50 pounds and sounded like a 747 on takeoff. And I said, what does that do? He said, well, you got your Mac here, right? I had an old classic Mac, and he said, I plugged it in. He said, you got a CD? I owned two CDs at the time, and one was the Beethoven Ninth Symphony. So I brought my CD over, and he stuck it in. And in about 20 minutes, he was able to show me that I could actually click on the mouse, and the music would play at a specific place. And this was really breaking all the rules, because normally you start a piece at the beginning, as you do here at the station, I'm sure, and you play to the end. And as a teacher for many, many years, I would give a lecture on, you know, Berlioz Symphony Fantastique. I'd play mostly at the piano. And the kids would, you know, write things down furiously and be very excited. And then my office hours that week would be, you know, I know you talked about this thing that happens in the waltz in the second, but where was that? Can you tell me where that was again? And now with MITA we can, because you have about 4,000 pages of fully interactive scores where you click on any bar and it plays exactly at that point. Yeah. And so this has empowered my students. I've been teaching with MITA for 8 years. We're going public next week. But the experience has been really extraordinary, because now they actually begin teaching the class. In other words, if they have the same materials as their teacher, I mean, the thrust in the textbook industry has been, we're going to give you multiple choice test banks. You don't even have to worry about that. We'll do the testing for you. And we're going to give you an outline of a lecture that you can read, a PowerPoint lecture you can read in class. You don't even have to spend 5 minutes preparing. Just walk in and read the lecture. Whereas MITA flips it so that the students have the power to teach themselves. And what my role has more and more become that of a mentor, a cheerleader. And once they realize, oh my God, it's us, the kind of personal responsibility that Jim Dozier was
talking. It's empowering.
It is enormously empowering. And so the courses I teach are, you know, that really changed fundamentally, because I say, you know, who's next? No, you're up here. And they learn, by the way, that playing MITA is a bit like playing an instrument, actually. You can't just sit or play, you know, a theremin or an onde martenot. You can't just sit down and use it. You have to sort of, you know, familiarize yourself. But once you can play it, boy, are you empowered.
Starting around what age are you expecting young students to be able to use MITA?
I did a 2.5-hour show in Guangzhou, China, with students between the ages of 4 and 7 years old. They were there with their parents, but just simply using MITA. and having the kids come up and play with it. And they were, you know, no bathroom breaks, no squirming in the seats. There's just a long line of kids who wanted to come up and play with it. So there is, and you know, and until your deathbed. I mean, music should have, I'm sure both Jim and Bob would agree, why would music be something that, you know, is for you between the ages of 40 and 65? Why isn't it something you start with when you're a kid?
So this should make it more accessible.
Well, look, the program makes no distinction between, for example, high art classical music and pop music. I talk about it all in the same way. So if you're Madonna, I treat Madonna, you know, the same way I would treat Mozart or anybody else in talking about their music. And the second thing, of course, is that the distinction we used to have between theory and history and performance, it isn't that I've knocked them down with a sledge. They just aren't there. You can toggle back and forth between what I call the languages of music and what I call musical context. All music history is just simply context. You're giving people context. And once they understand that, for example, I say, what'd you do on the weekend? And you say, well, I went to such and such and fished. Well, that's just the title of the piece that you did. You know, tell us, how was the fishing? You know, where was the lake? Create a picture of it for, and they begin to understand that's what music history actually is. And these things you can explore in a digital way that's almost impossible in any other form.
We're going public in the United States and in China, where Robert is very well known. He's taught often in China during the course of the last 20 years. Next week.
How can people get it?
Yes, that's what I was going to ask.
I know, that's what I'm wondering. People are listening.
It's available on a rental basis, and Robert will tell you how.
Okay. Well, it's a subscription model, and starting in the middle of next week, they can simply go to artsinteractiveinc.com. That's the word arts, the word interactive, and the INC for the corporation, .com. It's all one word. And the website will tell them, it'll introduce them to the program, show them around, and give them opportunities. It's basically a $12.95 per month subscription, but we have a $100 annual subscription sale that will be going for the next several months. And it's, you know, everything is a subscription model these days. My Microsoft Word, my Adobe Photoshop. And it's the way in which, you know, people don't buy things so much. The kids don't have this notion of they want to buy something. They simply want to know, how do I subscribe? And they just ask me, how do I subscribe? They just assume it's a subscription.
I'm thinking of my six-year-old who might benefit from this right away. I'm also hoping that eventually, as this grows, because it sounds like it will, you'll find a way to put it in the hands of people who couldn't afford that kind of a subscription.
Well, one of the reasons we have a company is to, you know, get some reserves where you can go out into schools and so forth. Yeah. I mean, the great thing about a program that's entirely digital is you have no warehouse. You have no molecule. You're not shipping anything around the country. So the if you have 1,000 subscribers or 100,000 subscribers, it's scaling it up is almost insignificant.
Let me remind our listeners who you're hearing. Robert Winter, Distinguished Professor of Music at UCLA. Bob Freeman, who is the former director of the Eastman School of Music and the New England Conservatory and former dean of the College of Fine Arts at the University of Texas at Austin. And Jim Dozier, director of the Institute for Music Leadership at the Eastman School of Music. In a moment, I'll grab a phone call. And before we go to break, let's get our only break of the hour. But before we do that, let me ask Jim, tell us again, part of the reasons that people like Robert and so many others are here this weekend, into this weekend, are for some events. And there's one today, tomorrow, Saturday. What do you want the audience to know about
that? Yep. I would point out that this is a rare time to hear all three, Bob and Robert and Paul Judy, who's distinguished in both in business and in music, to give these types of insights in a informal opportunity where that people can interact and ask questions. So it's Thursday at 4, today at 4, Friday at 2:30, and Saturday morning at 10 o'clock, all at Hatch Hall.
Very good.
Before you come to break, I'd like to end this section just by saying that Mita makes possible, for the first time in the history of music, the opportunity for non-musicians to look at and see music at the same time. George Eastman would have loved that.
Boy, would he ever. As we go to break, David on Twitter says, Robert, when someone offers you a free bottle of wine, you take it. So there's some advice from one of our listeners on social media. And perhaps we're going to hear not just about Mita, but maybe Robert will tell us who Beethoven's immortal beloved was. We'll get all of these things settled. Let's get our only break. We'll come back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, the remarkable observations of an author who came to the United States from Zagreb when her homeland was being torn by war. She offered her observations about the country in a book called American Fictionary, a dictionary-style book that took a look at American consumerism and culture. That book republished. She's in Rochester as a guest of Open Letter Books. We talk to her next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. There's always something mildly precarious with having me host conversations about classical music when I probably could feign an illness and import someone like Brenda Tremblay from Classical 91.5 right down the hall. She writes to us and says, "The death of classical music is its oldest, finest tradition." Well, let's hope that that continues, because that would mean that it hasn't actually died. And what we're talking about is the future of classical music, the present of classical music, the current audience, growing the audience, growing accessibility. AJ in Rochester is on the phone first. Go ahead, AJ.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'd like to say that one of your panelists brought up the three-legged stool concept, and I think that is very important. I have a degree in music, and studying theory and history at music school, there was no emphasis on how it made you a better player. There was no connection to actually performing the music. So I think that's very important to teach. The other thing that I would like to bring up is I think the most important thing in creating more accessibility in classical music to a wider audience is teaching performers to focus more on the emotional content of a piece, as opposed to things like pitch, rhythm, theory, history. Those things are really more accessible to people who have studied music before, and I think everyone who has listened to music at some point in their lives, whether or not they've studied it, has had that feeling of goosebumps on the skin that really connects them to a performance, you know, whether it's classical, pop, rock, whatever. So I think that should be the main focus in classical music, and not necessarily bringing in big names who were probably just jack up ticket prices. So I'd like to hear your thoughts on that.
AJ, thank you. We'll go around the table. Bob, go ahead.
Certainly agree that the music industry that we're talking about right now is dominated by figures who make big enough fees for an evening performance that somebody's willing as a business proposition to take 20% of it to promote it. That's certainly something that people learn in Jim's institute at the Eastman School, that you have to build your own reputation and your own brand, what makes you different from other people. There are all kinds of ways of doing this. I love to point to a couple of Eastman graduates who live in Austin, Texas, which is where I live now, married couple. She was a euphonium major at the Eastman School. There is no work for euphonium majors. She married a guy who was a composer and percussionist. She decided she would simply join her father's real estate firm, and the real estate market in Austin is expanding by leaps and bounds. Her husband, so she makes a lot of money doing that. Her husband formed a rock group with himself as percussionist and three cellos. There had never been anything like that before, and that has just exploded. He composes all of the music for it, and it's playing all over the world at big fees.
Robert?
I would just like to say that you're a very articulate caller. I refer to him as a survivor. That is, there are hundreds of thousands of survivors of music programs who manage to come out and still preserve their love for music. And, of course, I'm sure he knows as well as anyone that it is precisely rhythm and pitches and how they're put together that create emotions. Yep. We have this wall as if these are two completely different worlds, but they're the same world. And to the extent that students can begin to realize that, if you begin to really integrate your so-called curriculum, there's the potential is enormous there. And when kids start opening up that, I can say in class that this piece really moves me, or that this particular passage is what makes my day and so forth, yeah, you can say that. I might ask you, what is it about the music that it makes you feel that way? But that the feeling is, of course, at the center of music, always has been. And we know, you know, music goes back. There's a wonderful book by a colleague of mine at Yale, Gary Tomlinson, called A Million Years of Music. And I have a nice reference to it in Meat End, but basically what he does is he looks at the anthropological record, the archaeological records, which have been dominated by anthropologists, by archaeologists, by a few art historians, but music people never talked about it. And what we know is that music, the capacity for making music, developed over hundreds of thousands of years. In other words, you find a bone flute in a cave from 40,000 years ago, that doesn't mean somebody one day woke up and said, gee, I think I'll go and, you know, get this bone of an antler, of a deer and put some holes in it and play it. That probably was preceded by perhaps 200,000 or 300,000 years of culture. So in which perhaps hunting, you had to coordinate getting the animal. So you did, you know, bird calls or whatever. Whatever led to people first articulating this way then became part of the DNA. So you have the culture acculturating the DNA and so forth. Well, they weren't doing it because of, you know, abstract exercises, as your caller was talking about. They were doing it because... matter of life and death in some cases.
Yeah, there's real utility.
Absolutely. And because it was the expression of ritual. You know, in most cultures, and the very first entry in Mita for beginners is music. Now, you might say that's a pretty obvious thing. You know, we'll just play the, you know, Bizet Overture to Carmen. That's music. But in fact, you have thousands of years, including Western history, where there is no separate word for music. It is music dance. Music dance is the same word. In dozens of cultures across the world, whether it's the Maya or the you know, the Suya in central Brazil or the ancient Greeks, they all had this. And you, when you read these ancient treatises, you know, you're looking for the word music. It's not in there. It's always associated with bodily movement. And of course, when you sit in a concert, you have to be still. Right?
Now you have to understand also that the whole stereotypical division between what has been called by Dwight, John Sullivan Dwight, as Robert said, classical music, and other kinds of music is partly sociological and partly driven by the attempts of Americans in the middle of the 19th century to make some money off of pop music. There is no question in my mind that the role of serialism fostered by Arnold Schoenberg during the 20s, 30s, 40s, and by American universities all over the place during the 40s, 50s, and 60s, meant that new music was really difficult to get into. That hasn't been the case since 1965 or 1970, that new music is now exciting. And I'd challenge some of your listeners to go to YouTube and listen to a bunch of pieces by William Bolcom, B-O-L-C-O-M, who's just retired Pulitzer Prize winner from the University of Michigan faculty, and try to figure out whether his choral preludes on black gospel themes are classical music or pop music.
Hmm. They're very both. Interesting question.
They're yeah. both. Yeah. And there are composers who are writing music these days which simply cannot be sorted out and put in one or the other. It's true that popular music in the United States came from the African-American community. And with Elvis Presley's contribution during the 50s, went up the Mississippi River to Chicago, to St. Louis and Chicago and to New York, and became a dominant force in music by American composers of whatever race. One thing that I'm really proud of, I certainly didn't do it at the Eastman School, and that is, would you care to, you'll understand a lot if you can guess at which music schools were originally teaching jazz for the first time and when. The answer to that is the Eastman School, the New England Conservatory, and Indiana University in 1968, after Lyndon Johnson had passed civil rights legislation.
Mm.
Jazz was going to poison the classical music curriculum, you understand.
That
was the...
Well, you get
that
idea.
It would be the end.
You get the
idea. Jazz is what provoked the opprobrium of the community at the time? Yeah. Jazz?
The part of the answer to the question I gave you, which is also revealing of a lot about our country, the three institutions I just named taught jazz... and called it jazz for the first time in 1968. Hmm. The real answer is the University of North Texas in 1947, where there was a Canadian dean named Wilfred Bain, who introduced a program which was going to be called jazz, but the state legislature wouldn't let him do it, nor would the governor. So he called it instead experimental music. And the 1 o'clock lab band that still exists in Denton, Texas. But it was to get around the word jazz, which meant black, which was against the rules.
Evan, if I could just interject, we have the Thelonious Monk Jazz Institute at UCLA. And I teach graduate seminars in which I have a kid who can play the Paganini variations behind his hands tied behind his back as a pianist, but could not improvise a 1-5-1 thing to save his life, and kids who can play anything at sight and so but can't read Kinderzenen by Schumann. And to have those kids together for 10 weeks is absolutely extraordinary because they're in the same world. They actually are in the same world, but they're just, you know, one-armed or one-legged. And they grow the other leg during those 10 weeks, and they become whole musicians. So the opportunity, you know, for broadening, I mean, Eastman has a jazz program as well, is this kind of integration is we're all addressing the same issue. You know, how to bring it to people, the music that we love.
Okay. A really unusual idea that my colleagues and I at Eastman brought off at Alice Tully Hall in New York in about 1985, a very popular concert was called New Music and All That Jazz, in which maybe 25 Eastman students in white ties and full dress suits under Sid Hodkinson spent the first half of the program playing contemporary music by composers from all over the country. Then at intermission, they all changed clothes into sneakers and jeans. And Ray Wright was the director, and they all came out and played jazz for the second half. But the idea was you don't have to specialize in one or not to be a musician. It means learning all kinds of repertories.
Well, as we got down to our last few minutes, let me turn back to Jim Dozer, and I'll read one more email from a listener named Adam, who, because I think this will put a nice little coda on the discussion. He says, please, whatever you do, don't try to make classical music cool, and don't take the intellectual and historical roots out. I haven't heard anything this hour that takes the intellectual and historical roots out. I think, you know, for example, when Robert was talking about theory, which was sort of just the Trojan horse for just learning language and kind of dressing it up in big grandiose terminology and then maybe not contextualizing. I think we're taking, at least from what I'm hearing from you gentlemen, is that you're taking the history and you're contextualizing it. And it's still there, but you're more efficient in this new technology, and there's so much that you're doing to make it more accessible.
Mita begins with an 800-page, maybe more by this time, history of music of
go.
All kinds.
There you go. So when Adam says, though, please don't try to make it cool, what do you say to that?
So I think that's a great point, and it also goes back to the goosebumps that AJ was talking about. And that is what there's a shift in music education now that says that we have to not look at what the value is to us or to musicians or the industry. We need to look at what the value is and how to enable people to access that music. That's why in courses that we have at the IML, like entrepreneurial thinking, we start out with what is the value of what we do, not in our own eyes, but in the eyes of the listener, in the ears of the listener, in the hearts of the listener. So it's not ignoring a tradition or changing a tradition. It's finding ways to deliver that tradition and deliver the music and embracing all those forms in context that people can appreciate them on their own terms.
All right, Jim, about last minute here, let our listeners know what's happening today, tomorrow, Saturday.
Today's presentation at 4 o'clock is an interview with Bob Freeman on our from our Leadership Issues in Music course, where our audience will be able to participate. Tomorrow's presentation at 2:30 to 3:30 is Robert talking about digital learning. And Saturday is a panel discussion with 5 participants that are going to talk about the topic of what is the future of classical music.
Okay, all at Hatch, right?
Hatch Performance Hall, all free and open to the public.
Now, I know you're going to have a wonderful week and weekend, and I want to thank all of you for being here. I think you're really working hard on making sure that, as we say, music is accessible. And I think, Robert, I should ask you one more time, if we want to get our hands on the kind of technology that might help, what's coming our way?
The middle of next week, just go to artsinteractiveinc.com, and we'll tell you how to get started.
artsinteractiveinc.com. A lot of fun, and really looking forward to that. Thank you all for being here. Our thanks to Jim Dozer, Director of the Institute for Music Leadership at the Eastman School of Music. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Adam.
Our thanks to Robert Winter, Distinguished Professor of Music at UCLA. Thank you, Robert.
It was great fun.
And Bob Freeman, back in Rochester, and we're glad to have you back here.
I was born here. My wife was born here. And we love the place.
Well, wonderful. Former director, among many things, of the Eastman School of Music, 72 to 96.
Yeah. So
nice to have you back here. Much more connections coming up next.